All right. Good evening. It is the eve of Ta'anit Esther. It is the eve once removed of Purim itself. And as Rabbi Kelman mentioned, I thought that rather than the Haftarah of the Sidra of Tetzaveh, we would do a close reading of the Torah reading for Purim morning. As I pointed out to Rabbi Kelman, when I asked his permission, the Haftarah that we are skipping comes from the book of Yechezkel. However, the Haftarah of next week, that is the Haftarah of Shabbat Parah, is also from Yechezkel. So I think that Yechezkel will be happy and satisfied that we're paying sufficient attention to him. So I think that he would concur in our decision. So if I can ask you to think back for a moment to last week, when we looked at the Haftarah of Shabbat Zachor, we looked at the Kriyat HaTorah as well, in order to see the link between the Kriyah of Shabbat Zachor and the Haftarah of Zachor. And I'll just remind you that the opening verse in the Maftir in Parashat Zachor is Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek. Remember or take note of what Amalek did to you. Baderech b'tzeitechem mitzrayim, when you were on your way out of Egypt. The next pasuk kind of compresses it all into three words, saying asher karecha baderech, that they met you, some say they intercepted you on the way. That's the compressed version, because back in Sefer Shemot, when the episode was narrated for the first time in its proper historical sequence, it is given there in greater detail. That's the text that you see in front of you now. It's from the Sidrav Bishalach, the one that began with the actual departure from Egypt, the one that saw the crossing of the sea, and the one that saw several episodes, several incidents that followed the crossing of the sea. To remind you, there was one where they came to a place called Marah, where the waters were bitter, and Moses had to cut down a tree and cast it into the water to sweeten them. Then they came to a place where there was no water at all, and Moses got them water from a rock. Okay. In that same sequence of events that follow upon the successful crossing of the sea, there is the narrative of this incident that gives us considerably more details about just what it was that Amalek did to the Jewish people when they were on their way out of Egypt. And we're going to go through it really sentence by sentence, line by line. But before we do it, I want us to have some sort of a larger picture. That is to say, before we get to the trees, let's have a look at the forest. So here we have the forest. And you can see that, as I customarily do, I color-coded it. The color-coding is not difficult to decipher. Starting with the very first verse, Vayavo Amalek, Amalek came, Vayilachem im Yisrael, and they attacked Israel. They battled Israel, Birifidim, at a place called Rifidim. So you see that there are two color codes. One is kind of a pinkish and the other is yellow. The pinkish one is the one where, if you follow through, contains all of the different phrases in this story that relate to the battle itself. Okay, there's the opening phrase about Amalek, that it came vayilachem, and they launched an attack. Then in the next verse we have Moses' instructions to Joshua, which is vitzei hilachem ba'amalek, to do battle against Amalek. Okay. Then in the following verse, we have a description of how Joshua fulfilled Moses' instructions, lehilachem ba'amalek, to battle against Amalek. So those at the beginning of the story are the three phrases that are indicative of this military struggle, this military campaign. That's followed up towards the end of the episode. In verse 13, Pasuk Yod Gimel, where it describes Joshua's success over Amalek as Vayachalosh. We'll get to that in detail in due course, but for right now, it's sufficient to see that this is a military term. It's one of those things that is part and parcel of the word milchama. Okay? And I similarly colored in that same shade of pink, God's instructions to Moses, ki macho emche et zecher Amalek, God's promise, as it were, that he will erase, that he will surely erase or eliminate Amalek. That too, again, belongs to the family of the battle against Amalek. And so does the phrase in the concluding verse of this episode, that describes a milchama lashem ba'amalek, a battle that God wages against Amalek midor dor in perpetuity. So we can see that the element of battle is there in the very beginning, it's there at the very end, it's absent in the middle. However, in the middle, as you see, there is a nice collection of yellows. What do the yellows signify? If you see, the yellows are almost all of the references in this story that contain the word yad. And as we're going to see, the word yad and forms of the word yad, hand or arm, right, are a light vort, a leading word in this story. And indeed, hopefully by the time we're done, we will be able to see that the significance that we will attach to the continuous references to Moses' hands, to Moses' arms, will actually enable us to explain the meaning of the word Rephidim as the name of the place in which this battle against Amalek occurred. The green, as you see, are references to Moses. The blues are references to Yehoshua, to Joshua. Okay. And the reds are references to God. Now, you see that's very interesting, that God is right up there in the last three verses. But you take a look. There's no God in the beginning of the story. The story of the battle against Amalek takes place featuring Moses and to a lesser degree Joshua, but God plays no role in the story until the battle is over. It's only when the battle is over that God enters into the picture. Okay, all of these things I said are here and they are coded. To draw our attention to them. This is just simply another way of looking only at the handy feature, so to speak. Okay, we see the word Yad in the name Rephidim, kind of snuck into the word Rephidim in the opening verse. Then once again in the second verse, we have a reference to Moses saying that he's going to take a staff in his hand. And then in verse 11, we're told about Moses raising his hand and lowering his hand. In verse 12, we're told about Moses' hands being heavy and having to sit down, and how two of the people who accompanied him, and we'll get to them in a moment, assisted him by one standing on either side of him and helping him to keep his arms raised. And then the hands kind of take a little break for a couple of verses, but sure enough, they show up again in the closing verse when it's part of some sort of formula that Moses recites after he builds an altar to commemorate the victory of Amalek. So again, as I said, 8 references to Yad in an equal number of verses, surely attests to its service here as a leading word. Just what it's pointing us to, we will find out as all of this unfolds. And here we go to the unfolding. I can afford to make this a bit larger now because we're not going to be able to see the whole text any longer. Okay, that's a little better. Okay. So what I've done here, as you can see, very simply, is I have broken the story, the 8 verses or so that contain the narrative of the Amalek attack against Israel at Rephidim, and how, under the leadership of Moses and Joshua, they repulsed the Amalek attack, and what Moses saw fit to do to commemorate that victory. I've broken it down not only verse by verse, but sometimes within verses, I've broken it down clause by clause. And what we're going to do now, as I said, is engage in a bit of close reading. And here we go. Vayavo Amalek. Now, you remember that in Parashat Zachor, it says, Asher karucha baderech, who encountered you or who ambushed you on the way. Okay. Kara mikre usually means an accidental encounter. So did Amalek encounter Israel accidentally? Was it just simply a law of physics that says the two nations can't occupy the same territory at the same time? So when Israel and Amalek encountered each other in the wilderness, of necessity, one had to attack the other? No. We see here that it all began with Vayavo Amalek. It all began with Amalek coming. This was a deliberate encounter between Amalek and the people of Israel, not an accidental one. They came, Vayilachem, and they did battle against the Israelites. Okay. Notice, if you, again, that the verb lamed chet mem, to launch a war, to do battle, is accompanied in this verse by the preposition im. If you look, however, into the last segment of the very next verse, in Moses' instructions to Joshua, it says, tsehilachem ba Amalek. There, the verb lehilachem, to do battle, is accompanied by the preposition ba. Lehilachem ba is to launch, to fight a battle. Lehilachem im is to launch an attack. So the first thing that we can establish here is that Amalek was the aggressor. They launched the attack. The Israelite response was one of self-defense. Okay. What about Rephidim? You know, Rephidim is kind of midway. I'm not saying geographically, but textually. It's kind of midway between Yam Suf and Har Sinai. Now, I can tell you that here we are, more than 3,000 years, considerably more than 3,000 years after these events took place. And we do not know with 100% certainty where either Yam Suf is, or for that matter, even where Har Sinai is. Therefore, if the Torah comes along and tells us that the battle against Amalek took place in Rephidim, I have to ask myself, what purpose does that serve? Am I supposed to find it on a map? Am I supposed to, you know, to visit it in order to commemorate the battle? Not likely. The rabbis in such a case assumed that the name was not a proper noun that one could find in a geographical atlas, but they assumed that it was that it was a symbol. And they read into the word refidim, the word yadayim, hands, and the word rafeh, meaning weak. And they said that the word refidim is not a place, it is a description of the Jewish people. At when did Amalek launch its attack against Israel? At the time that Israel was refidim, that its hands were weak. What does it mean that its hands were weak? Since this, again, according to the rabbinic take on it, is symbolic, they understood it spiritually. After all, as I mentioned when we began, this episode takes place after their thirst was quenched and after Moses had supplied them with manna. Therefore, if their hands were weak, it wasn't weak in the physical sense. They weren't weak because they didn't have sufficient food or sufficient water. Therefore, the weakness had to be a spiritual one. And therefore, the rabbis understood the word refidim to mean rafu yedehem min ha-Torah, that their hands were weakened because they had abandoned Torah study. You may remember again that in the Parashat Zachor that we read last week, it says of the encounter between Amalek and the Jewish people, Va'ata, you, the Jews, Ayef v'yageya, you were tired, worn out from the journey, V'lo yirei Elohim, and you were not God-fearing. So basically what the rabbis did is they said, aha, see, they were not God-fearing because they had either entirely abandoned or they had somehow lessened their commitment to Torah. Okay. Now in the next verse, we come to the first issue that I want to discuss. Moses says to Joshua, Bechar lanu anashim, choose some men, v'tzehi lachem ba'amalek, and go out to do battle with Amalek. Machar, tomorrow, anochi nitzav al rosh ha-giba'ah, I will station myself on top of a hill, umatei ha-Elohim bi'adi, and I will take along my wonderful, miraculous rod. There are several problems here. If this attack by Amalek was of such proportion that we are summoned, invoked by the Torah to make at least an annual recollection of it. And you may remember that we pointed out that there are some people who recite the Parashah of Zachor on a daily basis. Okay? If this attack by Amalek was of such magnitude that the Torah wants us to keep it sharp in our memories, if it was of such magnitude that the Torah says that God himself will assume the burden of the responsibility to take vengeance on Amalek, then my question is, first of all, why is Moshe delegating Joshua to lead the Israelite response to Amalek? Why isn't he leading it himself? My second question is, surely to meet an attack of such magnitude, it isn't enough to say, pick a few men. Why doesn't he mobilize the entire army? And third, if, again, is it an attack of such magnitude, why is he saying, and it's okay to wait until tomorrow? What's wrong with today? So I find these three questions to be at the core of understanding this story. Why does Moses delegate? Why does he believe that it's sufficient to meet this challenge with just a small number of soldiers? And why does he not see the challenge as being an immediate one that had to be met on that very day, why does he feel that it can be postponed until the morrow? Now, we read a bit more. Moses didn't just say to Joshua, go pick some men and fight. Moses did say that he was going to do something. Let's look at what Moses was going to do. Moses said that, first of all, he would station himself. Anochi nitzav. He doesn't say omed, right? I will stand on the hill. He deliberately uses the verb lehityatsev, which means to station oneself. It may be significant that that's a verb that appears over and over again in God's instructions to Moses on where and how to encounter Pharaoh. Because Moses also says that he's going to take along his Mate HaElohim. I believe I've already had the opportunity to point out, and if not, I'll take the opportunity now, that the word Elohim isn't always a noun in the Bible. Occasionally, it's an adjective. A Mate Elohim is not God's staff. God doesn't have a staff. Elohim here is an adjective meaning divine. Divine is a form of hyperbole, is a form of exaggeration. Something that is so far out of the ordinary that the superlative isn't adequate can be accompanied by a divine appellative, by a form of the name of God, in order to impress upon us its extraordinary status. Give you an example. The Torah says that man was created B'Tselem Elohim. Tselem Elohim cannot mean an image of God, God's image, because as Maimonides taught us, God has no image. God has no form. Therefore, the word Elohim there is not a noun, it's an adjective. It means that the form in which God created man is so vastly superior to the form assumed by any of God's other creatures that the Torah uses a form of hyperbole linking it to God to tell us of its exceptional nature. So again, Moses uses the verb lehityatsev, which was part of God's instructions to him on how to encounter Pharaoh. And he says that he's going to take along this staff, this rod, which was the rod with which he accomplished several of those miracles that he performed in Pharaoh's presence. So something tells me that Moses saw this occasion, this response to the Amalek attack, in terms of his earlier experience with Pharaoh. And there's more. The next verse says that Joshua did what Moses told him, to go out and to fight against Amalek. And meanwhile, Moses, in the company of Aharon and Hur, ascended the hill. Now, I have some problems with this too. If the Torah has to tell us that Joshua followed Moses' instructions, does that not open the door for me to scratch my head and say, do you mean that there was a possibility that he might not follow Moses' instructions? You have to come and tell me Joshua followed his instructions because it might have occurred to me that Joshua would not follow them? Does that perhaps imply that Joshua saw some, if not all, of the same problems with Moses' response that I just enumerated? Second, Moses doesn't go up alone to the top of the hill. He takes along his brother Aaron and his nephew Hur, the same two people whom you may remember because it's the end of the Torah reading of 2 weeks ago. It's the end of the Sidra of Nishpatim. When Moses went up to the mountain to receive the Luchot, he left Aharon and Hur in charge of affairs in the camp. He said to the people as he was leaving them, "Hinei Aharon v'chor imachem mi ba'al devarim yigash aleihem." That Aharon and Hur are remaining behind, and anybody who has any matter that needs adjudication should approach them. So on the one hand, it's kind of obvious why, if Moses was going to take anybody up the hill with him, why he would take Aharon and Hur, because they are essentially his number two and number three people. But why does he need anybody? Could it be that he anticipated a need for their assistance? I don't know. It does turn out that he needs them. We already made mention when we went through all the references to hands that there reaches a point at which Aaron and Hur stand one on either side of Moses and help to keep his arms raised. Arguably, if they hadn't been present, Moses would not have been able to keep his arms raised, right? And that might indeed have had a significant impact on the fortunes of war. So could it be that Moses wasn't 100% confident in what he was doing? And he took along Aharon and Hur just in case? Let's go on. Now we have a description of the event itself. Vahaya. Okay, just going to try to highlight that word so you can see where we are in the text. Sorry. Okay. And it was, whenever Moses raised his hand, Israel got the upper hand. Pardon me. But whenever Moses lowered his hand, then Amalek prevailed. Do you notice that it uses the singular form, yado, in both cases? It's as though Moses, once again, is overconfident. Okay, says Moses, you know, we're going to go out. We have soldiers. The soldiers are going to go out to fight against Amalek. But we need some sort of symbolism as well. So I'm going to be the symbol, me and my staff, right? Because the people have come to recognize Moses and his staff. You remember, Moses raised his staff to split the sea. Moses raised his staff to get water from the rock. Okay, so the people are accustomed to associating Moses and his staff with a positive outcome. So perhaps Moses, as to build the people's morale, says, you know what, Joshua, you take the soldiers, you go out to the field of battle. I'm going to stand on top of a hill, clearly so that I will be visible to you and to the soldiers you will choose. And I'm going to stand there with my stick in my hand so that this will, you know, this will give a boost to the soldiers' morale because they associate me and the stick, as I said, with a successful outcome. So Moses starts off by raising his stick in one hand. And indeed, as long as Moses keeps the stick upraised, the Israelite soldiers prevail. But when Moses lowers his arm and the stick, then the Amalekites prevail. Now, of course, there are two obvious questions to this. The second of the two obvious questions is, so why did he ever lower his hand? I mean, once he saw the first time that if he lowered his hand, the tide of battle changed, then why didn't he just keep it up all the time? Right, the answer, I said, that's the second question and the smaller one because the answer's in the very next pasuk. But there's another question. The first question is, what is this? Is this just some kind of leisure domain that Moses raises a hand and the tide of battle goes in one direction, and then Moses lowers his hand and the tide of battle turns? I mean, almost as though you can see it as a cartoon with Moses standing there and going, look, look, right? With the tide of battle turning. And of course, the rabbis didn't see it that way. And there's a very famous Mishnah in Masechet Rosh Hashanah that asks rhetorically, V'chiyadav shel Moshe osot milchama o shovarot milchama? Is it possible that it's just Moses' hand that initiates the tide of battle? And the answer to the rhetorical question is no, of course not. Ella kol zman shehayu Yisrael mistaklim klape ma'ala. When the Jewish people looked up because Moses was on a hill, and they looked beyond Moses, umishabdim et libam la'avihem shabashamayim, and they realized that Moses wasn't Moses in his hand or the stick that were dictating the tide of battle, but that it was God who was dictating the tide of battle, and that Moses was just simply symbolic of it, because he was standing, first of all, on an elevated place on a hill, and secondly, he was holding his hand up in the air, and third, he was holding a long stick in his hand, so as almost to point towards heaven, to draw people's attention there, right? Therefore, essentially, the rabbis are answering one of the questions that we posed when we took a look at the whole story. And you remember that I showed you that I had highlighted God in red, and that there are references to God in the last three verses of the story, but no reference to God at all before the end of the story. That is, while the battle is taking place, there is no overt reference to God in the story. Now we see that there was a covert reference to him. And the covert reference was by way of Moses and his upraised hand and the stick that he held, which were important not in and of themselves, but only insofar as they directed people's eyes and directed people's minds towards God above. Then, as I said, we have the simple question of why Moses did not simply keep his hands raised the entire time. And the answer to that is V'yedei Moshe kvedim, that Moses' arms were heavy. Apparently, here now, all of a sudden, it's Yedei in the plural, which leads me to believe that even though in the previous verse it refers only to Yado, to Moses' one hand, I would suggest that he was probably alternating them, that he would keep one hand raised until it got tired, and then he would transfer the stick to the other hand. But eventually both of his hands grew tired. So what happened? Aharon and Hur took a stone, vayikhu evem, and they placed it beneath him, vayasimu tachtav, vayeshev aleha, and Moses sat on the rock, v'aharon v'chur tamachu v'yadav, and as I've mentioned already a couple of times, Aharon and Hur supported his hands, mizeh echad u'mizeh echad, one of them standing on each side of Moses, and since now they were supporting his arms, vayihi yadav emuna ad bo hashamesh. Therefore, his hands were able to remain steady or upraised until the sun set. And because of that, because this inspirational figure, right, that drew their attention and reminded them of their subjugation to God and reminded them that it was not Moses and not Joshua, but God who was being victorious on their behalf. The result is, Vayachalosh Yehoshua et Amalek ve'et Amo lefi charev, that Joshua was able to do something to the Amalekites and to their camp followers with the sword. The question, of course, is what was he able to do to them? Now, here you see that the Jewish Publication Society translation is to overwhelm, but the Hebrew seems to point in a different direction. The Hebrew uses the verb Vayachalosh. Okay? Which I'm sure some of you know from Yiddish, right? In Yiddish, if you're feeling faint, you say, oh, I'm going to chalash. Chalash means to be weak. Chalash in proper pronunciation. The Hebrew seems to suggest a lot less than overwhelming. I'm pretty sure that the choice of overwhelming was influenced by the last words, lefi charev. Because, you know, you overwhelm somebody by the force of arms. You can also weaken somebody by the force of arms. And I'm arguing that that's probably a more precise understanding of the verse. Because the one thing that's abundantly clear is that Joshua was not victorious to the extent that he eliminated Amalek as a threat to the Jewish people. We know that very simply from the fact that, what did we do last week? We looked at the Haftarah of Parashat Zachor, which were God's instructions to King Saul on to take a final act of revenge against the Amalekite nation. So clearly, if Joshua had been successful in eliminating the Amalekite threat, then there would have been no Amalek for Saul to battle against. The fact that Amalek is not only present in the time of Saul, it's present during the time of the judges as well, is testimony to the fact that Joshua did not eliminate the Amalekite threat entirely. What he did is well attested to in the verse by the word vayachalosh. He weakened them. They had to withdraw. They withdrew from the battle. They took their wounded with them, right? But as the saying goes, they lived to fight another day. Now, remember, we started off with questions about Moses' overconfidence. Moses didn't feel that he had to lead the people himself. He thought he could delegate to Joshua. Moses didn't think that he needed to mobilize the entire Israelite army. He thought it was sufficient to say, Bechar lanu anashim, pick a few men. Moses didn't think that the threat was so immediate. He didn't say, do it now, do it quickly. He said, machar, this time we can wait. And I described that as overconfidence on his part. An overconfidence that also is represented by his choice of the word nitzav and his taking along of his mate Elohim, which, as we pointed out, were reminiscent of the 10 plagues, reminiscent of his encounters with Pharaoh. Because the encounters with Pharaoh, and for that matter, even the splitting of the sea, were undertaken under very different circumstances from the ones that prevailed at the time that Amalek attacked. If I can remind you of one particular verse as the Israelites were hesitating, caught, trapped between the approaching Egyptian army on one side and the sea on the other, Moses says to the Jewish people, Hashem yilachem lachem ve'atem tacharishun. On this occasion, he says to the Jewish people, God will do the fighting for you. You can remain idle. My feeling is, the sense that I get from reading this story, is that when Amalek attacked, Moses went backwards in time and thought that once again he was standing with his stick in his hand, poised between the enemy on one hand, this time Amalek, right, and the wilderness on the other hand, and that once again God would intervene on behalf of the Jewish people, and that all that Moses and the Jewish people would have to do is something symbolic. And the symbolism was, Joshua, take a few soldiers, go out onto the field of battle tomorrow. I will stand on the hilltop with my stick, right? And Deus ex machina, right? God out of heaven will intervene on our behalf. And what I suspect that Moses missed was the signal from God that things had changed and that they were no longer in a situation where they could rely implicitly on God's intervention, but that now their fate rested in their own hands and depended upon their own actions. And arguably, if Moses had himself mobilized the entire Israelite army and gone out immediately to meet the Amalekite charge, they may have been so successful that Amalek would have been entirely eliminated as an opponent of the Jewish people. And I think that shows up in the end of the story as well. Here's the end of the story. God says to Moses, "Ktov zot zikaron basefer," write this down as a reminder in a book, "v'sim bo'oznei Yehoshua," and make sure that it's not only written down in a book, but make sure that it becomes an integral part of an oral tradition, namely, "ki machol emche et zecher amalek mitachat ha-shamayim," that I, God, speaking in the first person, right, I will surely erase, eliminate the memory of Amalek from beneath the sun. Not the Jewish people, but God. Okay. Now, nowhere does God tell Moses to make sure that the crossing of the Red Sea is written down in a book and made part of an oral tradition. This is unique in that respect. And I think that its uniqueness is because Moses and the Jewish people had acted properly at the time of the crossing of the sea. And therefore, it had already become a natural, an integral part of their culture. It was precisely because their response here was not what God anticipated, that he was making sure that the lesson that they would have to learn from this would not be forgotten. And therefore, what does Moses do now? He goes out and he builds an altar, and he gives the altar a very strange name. He calls it Hashem Nisi. Now, we know the word Nes primarily as a sign or a miracle. Okay, but there's another meaning to the word nes, and that is when it's derived from the verb that gives us the word nisayon. And my argument is that Moses named his Mizbeach Hashem Nisi not to say, God is my miracle, God is my sign, God is my wonder, but it was to say Hashem Nisi, God tested me. I think that Moses now appreciated that this was, in a certain respect, a test, and that by his display of overconfidence, he did not pass the test. I'm not going to give Moses a failing grade, but I'll certainly tell you that he didn't get an A. And that's why he continues. And he says at the very end, Vayomer. The question, of course, is who this Vayomer is. Is this Vayomer God, or is this Vayomer Moses? Okay. Arguably, right, since Moses is the subject of both verbs in the previous sentence, Vayiven and Vayikra, then the most likely subject of Vayomer is Moses. So what does Moses now pronounce? What does he pronounce over his altar? Ki yad al kes yah. Yad again, right? He understands and appreciates now the significance of the yadayim, right? So he mentions, he says, if I place my hand al kes yah on God's throne, as we do, for example, when we take an oath and we place it on a Bible. So effectively, by placing his hand, as it were, on God's throne, Moses is taking an oath. And the substance of his oath is, Milchama Lashem Ba'amalek Midor Dor. He makes it such an integral part of Jewish culture and tradition that from one generation to the next, people will pass the word along that it is a milchama lashem ba'amalek, that it is a battle that God will pursue against Amalek. This takes me back to the beginning and to wonder whether you have anticipated my last comment for this evening. And that is that if the word refidim is a combination of the word rafeh, meaning weak, and the word yadayim, meaning arms, it wasn't the arms of the Jewish people that were weak at this moment. It was, as the story tells us, the arms of Moshe Rabbeinu. And I would argue that the place was not called refidim when Amalek attacked there. It may have been just any place in the wilderness with no name. But what struck the Jewish people as one of the most, if not the single most memorable feature of this entire episode, and the one with which they chose to commemorate the lesson that they learned, the lesson that as much as looking heavenwards reminds us that God is in charge and that our fortunes and our fate are dependent upon our belief in and trust in God, that the age or the era in which we could just simply sit by and watch God intervene on our behalf has come and gone. And that, to quote an old proverb, we now live in an age where heaven helps those who help themselves. And therefore it was the Jewish people who called the place Rephidim in order to commemorate the fact that it was Moses' overconfidence, symbolized by his upraised hands, that got them into this predicament, and that it is a predicament from which they have not yet emerged, because Joshua was not successful in defeating Amalek, but only in inflicting a wound on Amalek. And therefore, if every time they retold the story, they made sure to say, and by the way, it happened in Rephidim, the place of the weakened arms, and that would remind everybody of Moses' overconfidence and that it was something not to be repeated again, then I would submit that that is exactly what God intended to happen when he told Moses to make sure that it gets written down in the book and becomes part of the oral tradition. And with that, I wish you all a very, as merry a Purim as we can come up with in this era of sometimes isolation and apartness. But let's take a quick look at the chat. Okay, Joshua could fight by directing the battle, actually fight. Okay, Israel commanded Achara. Okay, that's good. I mean, that doesn't say, it still doesn't explain why Moses couldn't have done the same thing. Okay. Persians, Greeks, Spartans. You know what Spartans remind me of? Spartan reminds me of Gideon. How many Spartans defended the pass at Thermopylae? Come, you must have seen the movie, right? The 300. How many soldiers did Gideon take with him against the Midianites? 300. There's something there. Okay. Is the document inscribed this another of our lost documents? I don't know what another of our lost documents means. I don't know which other documents are lost. The rabbis managed to identify all of the texts mentioned in the Bible with the Torah. So if there's a reference to Sefer Milchamot Hashem, the book of the wars of the Lord, that's the Torah. If there's a reference to Sefer HaYashar, the book of the upright, that's the Torah. And if it says K'tov Zot Zikaron BaSefer, inscribe this in the book, then that's the Torah. Okay. Moses was too valuable to lose. Joshua was expendable. Yeah, you know, but they had the confidence. They had the confidence. Look, another question that you could ask is that, you know, this is the first reference to Joshua in the Torah. You know, Moses doesn't send out the army in the charge of Aaron or Hur or Nachshon ben Aminadav or Kalev ben Yefuneh, right? He sends them out in charge of somebody we never heard of before. That too might be a sign of overconfidence. Anyhow, that's where we are. Rabbi, it's yours.
Thank you very much. A very creative shiur. You know, it's the shortest leaning of the year, as I think many people know. There's a halachic discussion. There are only 9 verses. And of course, you're not supposed to read the Torah unless there are 10 verses. But Purim becomes the exception to the rule. And I think we so focus on Amalek, on Kiteitse, you know, on Parshat Zachor, the 3 psukim there, that we often don't read the story in Beshalach. And when we get to Beshalach, you know, we focus on Kriyat Yamsuf. It's like the end of the Parsha. We don't really get there so much and so many else going on. So really, thank you for, I think, a very original take, at least from my perspective, an original take. Okay, just like I mentioned, tomorrow, just the one shiur in Parshas were 8:30 by yours truly. Everybody is welcome if after Megillah reading and you've eaten a little bit. Since Purim, of course, leads into Pesach. So I'll mention next Wednesday at 1 p.m., Rabbi Aaron Adler, who I think they just had a review today. I haven't read it in Israel, but his new book on Rav Soloveitchik. So I think got highly reviewed and a number of Israeli papers just came out. We'll be starting a 3-part series on the Ravs like Pesach. Rav Soloveitchik, of course, he was a shamus of the Rav. He was the Rav's, you know, personal assistant back in the 1970s before he made Aliyah. So he was very closely intimate with the Rav. So he'll be giving, as he did this, if you may recall, before Yom Kippur, the Rav's Yom Kippur, very interesting, a 3-part series. Now we're going to do the same thing before Pesach. That'll be next Wednesday at 1. Marty Lakshin has like 2 more parts. We're going to have a 4 shiurim next Wednesday. Marty Lakshin and Rabbi Adler and Lori Novak and Dr. Sokolow making up on Yecheskel to Daf Torah. Mm-hmm. So that's just one. We're going to have, we have a few more shiurim, but I want to let you know. I mentioned earlier today at the Chana Henkin, Rabbi Nit Chana Henkin will be giving a talk on her late husband who just passed away, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the response of discussing not this, his halachic response and the influence it had in the modern Orthodox world, whatever, the Orthodox world in general. So that'll be March the 7th. We'll keep you posted. Otherwise, all the regular shiurim. So I want to wish everybody a Purim Sameach. Those hope to see you soon, to learn with you soon. And it should be days like Hudimai to Erev, or what's it?
Simcha,
Simcha, and all, you know, Meyagon the Simcha, Meyavil Yontav, it should be the month, as we mentioned a number of times. Purim was when the whole corona kicked off in a big way last year, Purim. So let's hope this year Purim will mark the beginning of the end of the end of this whole thing, and that we can get back. One last question, Doctor. How old was Yoshua at this incident? We don't really know. The Torah doesn't tell us. I don't know. Do you have any idea?
He died at the age of 110.
Right.
So. And at the last 24 years, so then 24 and 40... since this is the building with us, 64 years. So subtract 64 from 110 and makes him 56.
46.
Okay, 46.
46, I think, if my math is correct. Yeah, that's the good age to become the army general. chief of staff, or whatever you want to call him, at 46. That's actually right, of course. Okay, very good. Okay, everybody, Laila Tov and Purim Sameach. And for those who can make it tomorrow night, we'll see you and have
Purim Sameach.
Freilich and Purim, as they say, I think in the languages I don't know, but anyways. All right, Laila Tov.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. Thank you
very much, Jay.